celebrating our 25th anniversary.
Welcome back to another edition of the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. A true pleasure to be with you this morning. Beautiful weather. It's getting to be that wonderful time of year. And I'm especially happy to welcome back to the production board my friend and helper, Michael Dumont, who has been out, had some surgery earlier this year. And I walked in and surprise, surprise, there he is. It is a pleasure to see you. It is a pleasure to have you back and to welcome you.
Thank you, Leo. It's great to be back, and I'm looking forward to future shows with you. And, well, I'm just happy to be back. Thank you.
I hope you're feeling great, and I hope you continue to heal and improve. A few housekeeping items before we get into the show. The second half of today's show is going to be my interview with George Soros that just took place. And the lead up to that interview is going to be a discussion about the war on terror that I'm going to conduct. So I don't think we're going to have any time for calls today. That makes 2 weeks in a row. I'm sorry, but as we know, our time is limited. October 28th, New Capital will have its first co-sponsored event. Mark Lesser, the author of ZBA, who was previously a resident at a Buddhist monastery and then has went into business, wrote a book called ZBA that I've talked about, The Zen of Business Administration, will be doing an all-day workshop at the Emerson Unitarian Church. It is co-sponsored, primarily sponsored by the Houston Zen Center, and New Capital Show is co-sponsoring the event. And I urge any of you who feel like you are really stressed out at work and you need to find another way to approach your work, you need to find a way to become more mindful about work when you're engaging in it. You need to find a way to be able to disengage from work when you need to do that. You need to find a way to quiet your mind in a whirlwind day. This is the workshop for you. This workshop, I think, will help improve your productivity, lessen your stress, and provide many other benefits in your life. So I hope to see you there. The date is October 28th, and if you go to newcapitalshow.com, in the top right-hand corner is a list of events, and Mark Lesser is there. So I hope that you will make your sign up now. Tonight at the Hobby Center, George Soros will be appearing as part of the Progressive Forum's Fall Speaker Series. And, of course, George Soros will be interviewed on this show in about 30 minutes. George Soros will be talking about the war on terror and following up on his latest book, The Age of Fallibility, which I read. Quite interesting. And it's a real treat to have someone of George Soros' caliber come to Houston, and Randall Morton is to be congratulated for doing that. I think there are still tickets available. There are links on newcapitalshow.com to the ticket, to the online ticket selling process. And I think it will be a very interesting presentation that George Soros will make. George Soros, well, I'll give a biography of him later in the show. Here's an interesting piece of news. The New Capital Show is going to be adding a television show. Believe it or not, the New Capital show is being ported, transferred to television. I don't have all the details that I can give you right now, but I can tell you that it's probably going to be in October. Stay tuned for additional details on that. They are being worked out as we speak. That's right. A little update on the TXU, on the TXU situation. I did a show a few weeks back on the Dallas-based utility. I had a guest on, Randy Loftus of the Dallas Morning News, and we talked about the fact that TXU wants to build up to 15 or so coal-burning power plants, and these power plants will use older technology and will not do much, if anything, to reduce their CO2 emissions. And I noted the fact that the governor, Rick Perry, had fast-tracked the approval process of this. Doesn't mean they're approved. It just means that the process you have to go through to get approval has been fast-tracked by the governor. So that what normally took a year of study and document generation now takes only a few months, 6 months I think it is. And Mayor Laura Miller of Dallas and several other communities in Dallas that would be impacted by these plants, because they are down, the municipalities are downwind of the plants, have formed a coalition to, I don't want to say stop the plants, but to force TXU to upgrade the technology used in the plants. And the news this week is that the mayor of Houston, Mayor Bill White, has joined this coalition. So Houston has now joined this coalition to force additional study and hopefully dramatic upgrades of these plants, and perhaps to slow this approval process. Steve Sussman, the great litigator of the law firm Sussman Godfrey, has been hired to do legal work on behalf of the city of Houston. And I have some clips on newcapitalshow.com linking to that. If you go back to the TXU episode, at the bottom of the episode is an update. And I'm trying to think of the best way to update stories, because let's face it, just because New Capital Show does a story on something, that story doesn't end by any means. The news goes on. Things change. The story evolves. And so I'm trying to think of what is the best way to keep that story updated on the website. And I think the best thing to do is to staple additional updates to the original episode. Maybe you disagree. You'll tell me. The other way that blogs do it now is they slipstream them in, you know, and you just get this kind of running commentary. But it's very disorganized. It's hard to follow the whole story. So I feel like the best way to do it is to staple updates to a story to the end of the original episode. So I'll be interested to know your thoughts on that. I want to make sure the website continues to be a source of information on these issues, because they don't stop just because the episode is over. Very often, it's just beginning. So that's the TXU story. It looks like it is indeed shaping up to be what I thought it would be, a very big environmental story, perhaps the biggest environmental story in Texas over the next 12 months. Next, there was a report from several oil companies of a large find in the Gulf of Mexico. The report from the news, you saw these blaring headlines, could increase U.S. reserves 50%. could be anywhere from 3 billion to 15 billion barrels of oil. Now, that sounds like a lot. Oh my goodness, we're going to absolutely increase our oil reserves in this country by 50%. But, of course, if you've been listening to the New Capital Show, you know that this country has only about 22, 23 billion barrels of found reserves anyway. And you would know that this country consumes 8 billion barrels a year of oil and rising. And so you would know that the news, of course, trumpeting 50% increase could be 3 billion barrels. What is that? A third of a year. So this incredible new find that you are seeing headlines about, and that people are tripping all over themselves to tout as, you know, going to save the U.S. from itself. If you know the numbers, you know that in terms of a long-term strategic energy plan for this country, it will do nothing to change the facts, which is that this country will always be utterly dependent on foreign sources of oil until our oil consumption profile changes. How you read the news is critical. I had a business school professor once. We did a business school case, and he was harumphing down on one of the students. He said, "What is that? You're holding a piece of paper. What is that you're holding?" He said, "Well, it's a piece of paper. And the facts are written on it." The business school professor says, No. What you have is toner arranged on a piece of paper. Toner arranged on a piece of paper. And that's how you need to read the news, very critically, and as if toner was being arranged on a piece of paper. Because that's the case with this recent story on the find of oil. Great, okay, it's going to add some incremental amount if the oil is able to be extracted from that far down in the Gulf of Mexico. But all oil authorities agree it is not going to change the fundamental long-term problem that this country faces. And now we turn, of course, to the war on terror, which, in this commentator's opinion, so much of the war on terror grows out of a root cause, which is U.S. drive to dominate petroleum resources in the world. That's why we're in the Middle East. That's why we're hanging out there. That's why we've been hanging out there for months and months and years and years. If they were selling kumquats in the Middle East, I don't think that we would have Central Command Station there. We have got to recognize the fact that our involvement in that part of the world is based upon our need to control, to hegemonize petroleum resources. And like in jiu-jitsu, sometimes the best defense is to step away and to begin to form other ways of fueling yourself, other forms of energy. I talked last week about General Motors and the absolutely terrible decisions it has made in its pension plan, but also in its automobile engineering, which it should be good at, and specifically in the choices that it has made to produce automobiles that consume extraordinary amounts of gas, even though the technology far long now has existed to produce automobiles that get much better mileage, three times the mileage, 45 miles per gallon, not 15 miles per gallon. My mother bought a Prius the other day, Mike. I was saying my mother bought a Prius.
That's terrific.
I mean, when my mother buys a Prius, something's going on. A Prius, of course, is a car made by a Japanese company, Toyota. And I remember one of the earliest shows that New Capital Show did was with a guy named Irv Miller of Toyota Motors USA. I called up Toyota. I said, "You know, you guys have this new thing called the Prius, and it seems to be selling pretty well. I'd like to have you on to talk about it." Irv Miller came on, and he said, "Yeah, we're doing pretty well. We're kind of can't keep up." This was when gasoline was at $1.40 a gallon. And now look at the story of the Prius. Took her months and months and months to get the thing. So we turn to this war on terror, which, in my opinion, so much of radical Islam is coming out of places where the U.S. is attempting to assert control. And George Soros is going to talk tonight about his opinion of the war on terror. He's going to tell you, I think, that he's going to tell you what many people have said, that to make war on terror is not possible. You make a war on an identified enemy that possesses arms. So you can make war on Al-Qaeda, but you can't make war on terror. Terror is a socioeconomic phenomenon that grows out of this world. This country made an attempt to deal with difficult socioeconomic phenomenon back in the 1960s under President Kennedy when it established the Peace Corps, which was an attempt to project U.S. goodwill into other parts of the world, and a mission, I think, it is safe to say, that would be supported by many of us here at Pacifica as a way to bring peace. It's very difficult to bring peace through war. And so I turn my attention in the first part of the show to an article by Jim Fallows, James Fallows of the Atlantic Monthly. It's appearing in this month's issue of the Atlantic Monthly. An excellent magazine, by the way. I like it very much. Declaring victory. He says, the United States is succeeding in its struggle against terrorism. The time has come to declare the war on terror over so that an even more effective military and diplomatic campaign can begin. What is James Fallows talking about in this article? He says, Osama bin Laden's public statements are those of a fanatic, but they often reveal a canny ability to size up the strengths and weaknesses of both allies and enemies, especially the U.S. In the videotaped statement just before the 2004 U.S. presidential election, bin Laden mocked the Bush administration for being unable to find him, for letting itself become mired in Iraq, and for refusing to come to grips with al-Qaeda's basic reason for being. One example. Bin Laden said, contrary to Bush's claim that we hate freedom, let him explain to us why we don't strike, for example, Sweden. Bin Laden said, well, if we hate everybody who loves freedom, why aren't we launching attacks in Sweden? This kind of goes to the issue of some of the earliest CIA internal documents that were coming out in the early war on terror, when several CIA officials pleaded that the U.S. government understand that there are substantive, fundamental, geopolitical, economic issues with the U.S. in the world. It isn't just people who hate freedom. None of us are going to hold up Osama bin Laden as our paragon of democracy, or anyone, I'm not going to say none of us, but most of us, wouldn't hold up Osama bin Laden as someone we're ready to elect to lead us. I certainly don't and wouldn't. He committed mass murder in September 11th, and that did it for me. I'm off that train. Nevertheless, to think that we are waging a war only for reasons that others in the world don't favor freedom is to miss the point. And I think Fallows agrees with that in his article. Bin Laden boasted about how easy it had become for him to provoke and bait American leadership. All that we have to do is send two mujahideen to raise a piece of cloth on which is written al-Qaeda in order to make all of the U.S. generals race over there. And in fact, that appears to be what has happened in Iraq. Perhaps al-Qaeda's leaders, like most people, cannot turn a similarly cold eye upon themselves. And Fallows goes on to talk about how in this article, in preparation for the article, he talked to 60 experts about the current state of the conflict with al-Qaeda. And the conclusion of these experts, who are both military practitioners and academics, the conclusion is that the U.S. has made significant strides in its so-called war on terror, but specifically, it has made strides in making it difficult for al-Qaeda and other organizations like al-Qaeda to operate in the world. And in fact, Fallows posted on the Atlantic Monthly site recently a follow-up to the raids that took place in London, which we're still trying to understand the impact of. He says those raids only prove that success is being won in that type of operation, that financial impediments, that communication impediments, all of these things have taken place, and that there is no need to declare an eternal long war, so-called long war on terror, which in itself makes no sense to declare war on a concept, which is to say, had the Bush administration declared war on al-Qaeda, the Bush administration would at this point be able to declare victory in its war on al-Qaeda. Now we see in the past few days the Bush administration and the Republican propaganda machine is cranking up the rhetoric again by moving al-Qaeda operatives who were involved in September 11th or alleged to have been involved in September 11th, there hasn't yet been a trial, is moving those individuals to Guantanamo in an effort to force a showdown with Congress to promulgate rules for trials of those individuals because they have now been wrung out of all information and intelligence that they might have possessed by the CIA using clandestine and perhaps illegal methods. I myself have read articles that several of those who have been interrogated never gave good information, that torture produced what torture usually produces, which is bad information. When you torture somebody, you find some will either say nothing, and some will say whatever comes into their mind to stop it. And so, there have been articles which show that the information that's been gleaned isn't even of that much importance, especially those who are held in Guantanamo. And so it is very, very important. It is very important as we head into elections that the American public not knee-jerk itself into November. And I think this is part of the Democratic strategy, to get the American public to think in nuances. Who is it that we are actually fighting? How is it that it is best to fight them? What is it that we are actually facing in the world? What is going on in Iraq, and how is it best to deal with it? Is it Muslim fundamentalism that hates freedom, or is it sectarian hatred that dates back centuries? Do we have a role to play in it by our need to assert, or our desire to assert, hegemony over petroleum resources that are located in the Middle East? I truly believe that the American public is coming to see these nuances, and it is coming to see that the Bush administration is not and has never, ever advocated for an understanding of those nuances. At its heart, the Bush administration has advocated a hammer, because that's all that has ever existed in its toolbox. It's all, for all we know, that exists mentally in their toolbox. George Bush, we know, was not a well-traveled person of the world before he came to power. How can you lead the most powerful nation in the world if you don't know the world? And so we have articles coming out such as this one. This one is from this is from the Wall Street Journal. And it is a story about General Abizaid, who is of Lebanese descent, speaks fluent Arabic, and has been on the ground and in charge of, I think, the entire U.S. operation in Iraq. The article says, "The Fight for Iraq, a General's New Plan to Battle Radical Islam. Top Commander General Abizaid uses soldiers to build health clinics and dig wells." My goodness, this sounds like the War Corps is turning to the Peace Corps. And the U.S. may be learning lessons that we have already known now for four decades. If you want to win the peace, you must send the Peace Corps. Here's the article, a few minutes, and then we get to George Soros. In the fall of 2002, the U.S. military set up a task force here on the Horn of Africa to kill any al-Qaeda fighters seeking refuge in the region. The base was crawling with elite special ops teams, and an unmanned Predator plane armed with Hellfire missiles sat ready on the runway. Today, the base houses 1,800 troops whose mission is to build health clinics, wells, and schools in areas where Islamic extremists are active. The idea is to ease some of the suffering that leaves the locals susceptible to the radicals' message, thus bolstering local governments, which will run the new facilities and get credit for the improvements. Behind the shift is General John Abizaid, a 55-year-old of Lebanese descent and a fluent Arabic speaker who leads U.S. forces in the Middle East. And so on, the article goes. Abizaid says, "Military power can gain us some time, but that is about it." And so, as we begin the election season and the Republican propaganda machine cranks up about the war on terror, as the Republican fear machine cranks up to get you and everyone you know to be scared and frightened of all those out there who are there to get you, it is vital that you and I and all Americans think very, very clearly about how to go forward What is the way? What are the nuances? Because it is not a black and white world. It is a world of continuum, of grays. Now, we turn to my interview with George Soros. George Soros will be appearing tonight at the Hobby Center. Are we ready to go with the interview, Michael?
Yes, we are.
We're ready. I spoke with George Soros earlier. Here it is. George Soros is my guest today on the New Capital Show. George Soros was born August 12, 1930 in Budapest, Hungary, is a financial speculator, stock investor, liberal political activist, political philosopher, and philanthropist. He is the chairman of Soros Fund Management and the Open Society Institute, and is also a former member of the board of directors of the Council on Foreign Relations. His support for the Solidarity Movement in Poland, as well as the Czechoslovakian Human Rights Organization Charter 77, contributed to ending the Soviet Union's rule in those nations. His funding and organization of Georgia's Rose Revolution was considered by Russian and Western observers to have been critical to its success, although Soros himself has said his role has been greatly exaggerated. In the United States, he is known for having donated large sums of money to efforts to defeat President George W. Bush's bid for re-election in 2004. George Soros's new book is entitled The Age of Fallibility, Consequences of the War on Terror, in which he argues that America's current policies are the biggest obstacle to world order, that American culture is characterized by a desire to feel good and is anesthetized to realities, that 9/11 struck at a pervasive American inability to properly face death, and thereby resulted in unquestioning support of the Bush administration's counterproductive policies, and that America's decision to wage a war against a concept, that is to say on terror, is causing it to make poor decisions. George Soros will be appearing tonight at the Hobby Center here in Houston as the Progressive Forum opens its fall season. If you do not already have tickets, please check www.progressiveforumhouston.org for ticket availability. George Soros, it is my pleasure to welcome you to the New Capital Show today.
And it's my pleasure to be with you.
Mr. Soros, on election night 2000, my wife and I had a party, an election party. We had streamers hung from the ceiling, all sorts of balloons and so forth. We could not imagine that the streamers would have to remain up for several weeks after that. And certainly we could not imagine what a traumatic presidency that this would turn out to be. Did you have any imagining that it would be like this?
Not quite. I was disturbed by election and the outcome, but really only after 9/11 that I think that America has really gone off the rail in its response to the terrorist attack. There, the war on terror, and that was a false metaphor that was misused to support appropriate policies to eliminate criticism of the president's policies, and that's how we went so far wrong.
So you're saying in a way that 9/11 provided an opening to the Bush administration for its truer, deeper character to manifest.
That's right. I mean, basically, President Bush came out of the gate, having campaigned as a compassionate conservative, is a very radical, and particularly in foreign policy, in rejecting all kinds of international initiatives, denouncing the International Criminal Court, protocol for dealing with chemical weapons, a number of other things like that. But at that time, he did not have a real backing for his policies and couldn't carry them too far. Then came 9/11, and then by declaring war on terror, that's when, as I say, off the rails.
Mr. Soros, we will turn again a little bit later in this interview to issues of politics, but I first want to turn to your personal beliefs, philosophical beliefs. They have been critical to informing your worldview from a very early stage in your career, before you even came to money and to investment, you were working in philosophy. Could you discuss for the listening audience your concept of reflexivity and how it helps inform your political views? As I understand it, you are talking about how humans themselves perceive and actually create realities.
I think that the crucial point is that in trying to understand reality, we are unable to attain ultimate truth or a proper understanding of reality, because we are not just observers, but we are also participants. And the two functions of trying to observe and participating interfere with each other. So we operate on the basis of imperfect understanding, and our actions are by themselves a part of reality. So as a result, our misconceptions play a very important role in shaping history. And in that respect, you see, the war on terror is really a wonderful, not so wonderful, illustration of how a misconception can lead to unintended and adverse results.
I remember learning in high school about Plato's concept of the cave, and it seems that philosophers have been trying to understand the nature of reality for thousands and thousands of years. Of course, in the 20th century, we came to new understandings of reality, especially through physics and uncertainty principles. How does your concept of reflexivity fit in or extend from those earlier understandings?
I'm not sure that it does. I think it builds on a long philosophical tradition. But I think that let's say, in the Enlightenment, there was a tendency to separate the mind from reality, to focus on the mind as the observer and forget about our role as participants. And I think that was also, it was a very, what I call a fertile fallacy. It was a misconception, but it really brought very good results, because it led to the development of science, and of course in natural science, where in fact what we think doesn't really change how things happen. It was very, very productive. But then In social science, we tried to imitate natural science, and I think it led to a false conception of history.
Now, this is where you made a break with your great teacher, Karl Popper, who believed that the model could also be extended into the social sciences, and where you came to disagree.
Yes.
That human affairs are altogether different than physical natural sciences.
Right, but it turned out to be a very useful in my involvement in the financial markets.
Yes.
Because the prevailing theory was that markets tend towards equilibrium, whereas I believe that is not the case, because our misconceptions can actually be self-reinforcing.
Is this kind of like Warren Buffett's idea that to be successful in the markets, you should be greedy when others are fearful and fearful when others are greedy?
No, I think that is a very good sort of maxim to follow, namely to go against the prevailing trend. So there is actually a similarity there. But I think that I have sort of made a specialty in looking at these self-reinforcing processes, the boom-bust sequences. And of course, they don't occur very often, but when they do, they become very influential. Like you have the IT boom, and now you have an bust. And then you had the housing boom, and now you are facing the bust. And I think understanding how these processes reinforce each other can be helpful in anticipating them. And then I kind of applied the same philosophy to an understanding of other of political processes. So that's what guided me when I got involved in the former Soviet Union, in the collapse of the communist regime, and helped it along. And it's the same thing, the same sort of approach that I try to apply to the Bush administration's policies. I compare to a bubble.
This is Leo Gold. You are listening to The New Capital Show, and my guest today is George Soros. His new book, The Age of Fallibility, discusses America's war on terror and his criticisms of it. George Soros is one of the world's great investors, one of the world's wealthiest men, and a philanthropist who has supported democratic societies across the world. Now, you have taken your philosophical ideas and thought through to the point of envisioning open societies as optimal forms of human social contracts, human social arrangement, and conversely, dogmatic, static, fixed societies as the alternative to those. Could you talk a little bit about this idea of open society? It sounds as if democracy, liberal democracies, fit that bill, but you have also specified open society with some additional features.
I mean, I define open society as an imperfect society that holds itself open to improvement. So it's not the optimum in that sense, but it's one that is capable of improving itself and allows individual initiatives and enterprise. So it's sort of effectively a market economy and a democratic form of government, and that is not. Never perfect, but I think it's definitely preferable to a regime that is based on a dogma that holds possession of the ultimate truth, and because of that, is bound to be false.
So this is a society that is introspective and willing to revisit the validity, or consider the fallibility, as you put it, of its own conceptions.
That's right. It's very important to realize that we may be wrong. That was the sort of the message that Karl Popper tried to convey, and I actually take it a little bit further, because I even argue that we are actually bound to be wrong, because if we are right, we get carried away with our own success.
Which results in a boom-bust cycle.
That's exactly right, and that is what has happened to us, having won the Cold War, and our triumphalism led to the belief that since we are so mighty and powerful, that we have a right to impose our will and our interpretation on the world.
So the U.S. is in effect still, or rather much of the U.S. is still living in the afterglow of the World War II triumph.
It's actually more, not the World War II, it's more the collapse of the Soviet Union, because you have, you know, two superpowers confronting each other. We are now the sole surviving superpower, and we didn't become the sole surviving superpower by actually using military force, but now we have people in charge who believe that we should in fact use our military force to impose our will, and the war on terror sort of gave us license to do so, and that's how we ended up in the quagmire that we find ourselves in Iraq.
I am reminded when I read your book, you have a discussion about America being a feel-good society, and you tie this in with your thoughts on segments of the population, and I don't know that this is unique to the United States, but an inability to come to terms with death. I remember the first death I ever saw was the death of my grandfather, and it was an enormously sobering, deeply moving, and ultimately, it was very, very educating and very freeing, because I came to understand that death is not something to flee from, but something to accept. You postulate America currently as a feel-good society, and that is born out of a reticence to face death. Could you talk about that a bit?
It is rather interesting that when I set up my foundation in America as distinct from my operations in the former Soviet Empire. One of the first projects was a project on debt in America, because I felt that people in this country are not willing to accept and face the prospect of debt, don't know how to deal with it, and the way they deal with it actually makes the process more painful and more harm, more, I mean, both for the person who is dying and the family than it needs to be. And that actually was a very successful project, and we changed a little bit the way the caregivers, the doctors and the nurses deal with the issue, and perhaps to some extent the general public. Now, I didn't anticipate that what then happened with the terrorist attack, where the terrorists actually sort of hit on weakness in our culture, and it's the one area they found a weapon, namely suicide bombing or using the airplanes and killing themselves and others. The fact that they were not afraid of death enabled them to inflict tremendous damage and make a tremendous impact. And the fear of that, the fear of the terrorist attack, the picture of the World Trade Center collapsing, was a traumatic event for all of us. It shook us all to the core, so that was, let's say, how the terrorists exploited our fear of death. But then our own administration went even further in exploiting that fear. If you recall, President Roosevelt said, "You have nothing to fear but fear itself." But that's not how the Bush administration reacted. It exploited that fear to get the country to line up behind the president and allow him, his administration, to basically almost unlimited powers.
And in the wake of 9/11 in the 2004 elections, you made substantial financial contributions to organizations that were working against the re-election of President Bush. And when that failed, when President Bush was re-elected, although the margin again was not heavy at all, not large, you reevaluated and you felt that there were some substantial problems in American society itself, which has led to this book, and specifically you feel that America is suffering from this feel-good attitude.
That is correct, and we've got into a trap with this war on terror. The public now recognizes that the invasion of Iraq was a blunder, but people still accept the war on terror as the frame, as the be-all and end-all of our policies. And until we realize that this is a false metaphor that leads us to misconstrue things, I don't think we can extricate ourselves from the quagmire in which we landed.
Let me push back on this feel-good idea. One of my very good friends from business school is a petroleum, actually he's a chemical engineer for Shell, and we have frequent intellectual debates about the world. He concludes that the overall human project is guided by biology, and more specifically, by a drive for human comfort. That is to say that humans have a drive to make themselves comfortable over and above all other considerations. If it's so, and you may disagree that it's so, but if there's any truth to it, is America alone in this feel-good drive for comfort, whether it's psychological comfort or material comfort? Is this not something that the entire species is characterized by?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that this drive for comfort is actually the dominant aspect for all societies. In fact, I would dispute that. But I think you're right in saying that we are not the only feel-good society. I think that is characteristic of our Western civilization, and insofar as it is making inroads in other parts of the world, you also find it in other parts. So it's not unique.
This is the New Capital Show. I am Leo Gold, your host, and my guest today is George Soros, the famed investor and philanthropist, who will be appearing this evening at the Hobby Center as part of the Progressive Forum Speaker Series. You talk about market fundamentalism. You talk about this as an ideology that the Republican Party has used with great success over the past several decades to capture political power and to drive economic changes into the American landscape. You write in your book, the theory of private property needs the theory of perfect competition to justify it. In the unreal assumptions of perfect mobility and perfect knowledge, property carries with it not only rights, but also obligations to the community. Now, I have a friend, actually, with whom I'm estranged over politics. He's a Republican supporter. He was instrumental in helping to elect the current Lieutenant Governor of Texas, David Dewhurst, who is a Republican. And when we used to talk about environmental issues and social and community issues, he would insist that the only thing that really matters to him is individual freedom, period. I hear this all of the time from Republicans. So my question is, what are they talking about? What type of society do they favor? And how is that contrasted with your idea of a market mechanism interfacing with a community obligation?
I'm also a very firm and avid believer in freedom. This we have in common. But I don't think that freedom alone is sufficient, because there is also something that you might call social justice that needs to be considered. And also, the freedom of the individual has to be constrained by the freedom of other individuals. In other words, the freedom of one should not interfere with the freedom of others. So it has to be compatible. And for that, you need some laws and constraints. So while I'm a great devotee of freedom, it cannot be the only guiding principle.
I say frequently on this show that the major role of government is to protect the commons. And I describe the commons as those things which fall outside the sphere of private ownership. This might be the air, the water, things like social justice, perhaps pensions and medicine. And so it seems that you're arguing that individual freedom and protection of the commons are not mutually exclusive things.
You need to find the right kind of compromise, because the trouble with it, there's something called the tragedy of the commons. That is that the common property, it is not in the interest of any one particular member of that society to improve that property or even to maintain it. So, let's say the air is free, and therefore a manufacturer has no incentive to keep it clean, because he doesn't have to pay for the air. So these are economists call externalities, and externalities don't come into business decisions. And therefore, the pursuit of self-interest, individual self-interest, doesn't protect those common public goods like the air or the water or the environment or indeed the social fabric. People competing will not actually maintain competing markets, competitive markets.
You are listening to the New Capital Show. This is Leo Gold. I am your host, and my guest today is George Soros, the famed investor. Along these lines, you write, the markets best allocate resources, but we must make sure that the collective needs that would normally be ignored by markets, that they would be ignored by markets as externalities, that these externalities get proper recognition in the allocation education process.
That's right. Markets are designed to allow individual participants to maximize their interest.
Further along these lines, let me ask you this. Orthodox accounting theory, to which, in my experience, many conservatives believe that they are the high priests. They have the MBAs, the business degrees. They tend to lean toward Republican causes. This is not always the case, but it can be the case. They would insist that all costs be accounted for. This is what orthodox accounting theory would say. All costs in your production process or your process must be accounted for, and your goal is to earn a profit above and beyond that. Cost accounting demands that.
Right.
So we know that these elements of our population talk about accounting with great rigor on one hand, but they then send armies of lobbyists to shift many of their costs to the commons.
Right.
So my question is, why is remedying this not a more pragmatic focus of your efforts? Why is bringing the dangers of externalities to the forefront of the debate not a more major focus, or will it become a focus of yours?
It is, and actually one particular issue, which is global warming or climate change, is one that I think one cannot shy away from getting involved in. In other words, it's becoming it has become very pressing. The administration currently, the federal administration, is in denial, but I think the public has begun to realize. And I must say that I myself have come to it rather late. I was very much impressed by Al Gore's presentation going back to 2004, and that's when I realized that we really have to do something about it, and I am now getting engaged in this. But I hope to continue the discussion in the meeting later today.
Very good. Well, Mr. Soros, it has been a pleasure having you here on the New Capital Show. We look forward to seeing you later this evening at the Progressive Forum Houston. You pointed out Al Gore. Al Gore was the most recent speaker at Progressive Forum, so you will follow him up, and I'm sure it will be a wonderful, wonderful show. For those of you who do not have tickets, www.progressiveforumhouston.org. George Soros, it has been my pleasure having you on, and I look forward to seeing you later today.
Thank you.
Leo Gold back on the New Capital Show. That was a recorded interview with George Soros. Took place earlier. I want to thank Ernesto Aguiar for helping me with that interview. We have just a few minutes left. Again, if you need tickets, progressiveforumhouston.org. You can also get to that link from newcapitalshow.com. I want to try to sum up what the thrust of this show has been. You may have noticed George Soros and I dancing around these topics of markets, of community, of social justice. This, of course, has become the American project. Where are those lines drawn? Where do markets perform well, and where do their limitations come in and stop us from using them and extending their use? Where does the community begin? How are its interests defined? What is the best way to protect community interests? And can markets protect community interests? This, my friends, is the primary mission and goal of the New Capital Show. It is to try to help us understand where these two prominent forces in our society are, how far they can go, how they interact. Markets and commerce and community. And you heard George Soros say unequivocally, and he does say unequivocally in his book, and he'll say so probably this evening, that markets are good at doing some things, but they are not good at doing all things. And that is what I believe here on the New Capital Show. Markets cannot be depended upon to protect communal common interests, such as our air, our water, social justice, maybe pensions of the bulk of society, health care, and so forth. Markets will fail and have failed to provide for those things. Liberal democracies are very good ways of organizing ourselves. They are superior to dictatorships, for sure. And yet, in many ways, our country, after 20 to 30 years of Republican rule, has gone to one side of believing market fundamentalism. And you also heard George Soros and I talk about how the human mind works and how we glom onto ideas and hold them in dogmatic ways and get ourselves in trouble by going too far to one side. George Soros calls this a boom-bust cycle, a boom-bust mentality. And that is another thing that he advocates and that I also share, and I admire him for his beliefs about open society and about letting go of your dogmatic views of the world. Not only because they may be wrong, but because in believing the way that you do, you may ensure that they are wrong. Which is to say, Soros's idea of reflexivity is that the very thoughts that you have lead to actions which cause the world to change in those ways. I read an article earlier about John Abizaid coming to understand that the only way that we are going to truly change parts of the world that we want to change is to bring social justice by bringing schools and medical clinics, not by bringing missiles. And that is an understanding and an evolution in the thinking of some in the U.S. military. I do not see much change in the Bush administration that is leading this country, and that is why it is important that George Soros's words about the war on terror and the fact that the dogmatic way that the Bush administration presents our alternatives, you're either for us or against us, are a fallacy, a false way of thinking of things. And again, as we head into elections, it is critical that you, and not just you, but those around you, understand the nuances of the choices that we face as a country. It's important that we understand that there are more than one way to approach the problems that we face, and that some of those other ways may, in fact, be superior and more effective. Jim Fallows suggests that the time has arrived to declare victory in the war on terror. That's it. To simply say, that's it. It's ended. We fought a war on Al-Qaeda. We have succeeded in capturing their top lieutenants. They are now imprisoned in Guantanamo, and that episode is over. In his article, he suggests a speech. My fellow Americans, we have achieved something almost no one thought possible years ago. The nation did not suffer the quick follow-up attacks. Our troops have found the people who are responsible. Achieving this victory does not mean the end of threats. Life is never free of dangers. I wish I could tell you that no American will ever be killed again or wounded by a terrorist. But of course, I cannot say that, and you would not believe me. We have achieved a great victory, and we can give thanks for it. We will recognize the challenges, and we should recognize the challenges of including people left behind in the process of global development. The world's scientists have much to offer, and humanity has never needed their discoveries more than now to preserve the world's environment, develop new sources of energy, and improve the quality of people's lives in every corner of the world. Jim Fallows advocates declaring victory in the war on terror and getting out of it. George Soros agrees with that, and I agree with it as well. It has been my pleasure being with you for another edition of the New Capital Show. If you want to sign up to receive updates and newsletters and all sorts of other information, newcapitalshow.com. You can do it on the right-hand side of the page. And, of course, rebroadcasts of this show will be posted on the website later. There are places where you can offer your comments throughout the website. I welcome them, and I welcome hearing from you about anything that you may wish to address with me. Michael, welcome back. Great to have you. Great to see you. Take care. Have a great day.
Whether you love the Watusi, the Boogaloo, dancing with a partner, group, or just moving and grooving to the beat, you're invited to strut your stuff and enter the Houston Street Dance Competition, presented by the Third Ward Dance Collective.
Compete for cash prizes and an opportunity to perform at the Orange Show Gala. Auditions are on Saturday, September 9th, from 1 to 5 p.m. at the Orange Show, and the competition finals occur during the Orange Show's 25th anniversary celebration featuring Car Wars on Saturday, September 16th. 18.
You must reserve an audition slot by calling 713-926-6368. So call the Orange Show today to audition for the Houston Street Dance Competition.
Check out orangeshow.org for more information about the Houston Street Dance Competition presented by the Third World Dance Collective, KPFT Houston.
Calling all bike riders and volunteers to fight breast cancer. The Tour de Pink 2006 is fast approaching. On September 10, Pink Ribbons Project hosts its second annual fundraising bike ride. Riders raise money for Pink Ribbons Project.